Hello Vet Belters and welcome back. I apologize if you hear some background noise during this intro. It's raining on the Sunshine Coast, again, and my office slash studio is a tin shed, which is not a great combination in the rain. Also, if while listening to me speak during the actual episode, you find yourself having the immense desire to put a Strepsil or some kind of a throat lozenge into my mouth, I apologize. When we recorded this conversation, I was on the tail end of riding the COVID train, and it was 5 in the morning when I chatted to Ken because of the time difference. And while we're talking about apologies, here's something that really needs an apology. We are 70 plus episodes into The Vet Vault, a podcast for the vet profession, and we haven't had one conversation with a vet nurse or a vet tech. Now, I have excuses. We actually did discuss this question about whether or not we should extend our content to cater for specifically nurses as well as vets, even right back at the genesis of the podcast. And we decided to stick to the narrower vet niche, mostly because we're not nurses. And while we can talk with conviction about vet stuff, we felt that there were some excellent podcasts out there for nurses by nurses, so we'd leave it to them. But it's also about telling about some of the attitudes in our profession, right? We, and I'm talking about the collective we, spend a lot of time and energy on vets, vet education and vet wellness and career progression and. But then we tend to treat support staff as a bit of an afterthought. It's probably time for a change. In fact, as you'll hear from this conversation, support staff is probably not even the right term. The days when a nurse was a, and let's be honest, an easily replaceable, relatively cheap commodity are well and truly behind us. So let's talk about nursing. But first, let's talk about our guest. Who is Ken Yagi? Kenichiro Yagi is the Chief Veterinary Nursing Officer at the Veterinary Emergency Group, or VEG, in the US, where his role is to help develop career pathways in veterinary nursing and raising nursing care standards and competency. And for someone who claims to be socially awkward, he has had a hell of a career. During his 20-year career, he's helped redefine what the role of a veterinary technician or a nurse is, or can be, by constantly living his mission of promoting compassionate and progressive care for patients and their families. Ken is a registered veterinary technician and veterinary technician specialist in emergency and critical care and in small animal internal medicine with a master's degree in veterinary sciences. Don't worry, he explains what this means in the interview. He also serves as the program director for the Recovery Initiative, which is the global effort to standardize how veterinary CPR is performed around the world. He's received a host of awards, including the Veterinary Technician of the Year in 2016, and he's been pushing the standards of nursing for 2 decades through his teaching and training, speaking and writing. Now, who's this episode for? Well, we're sticking to our guns. This is still a podcast, first and foremost, for vets. So, this is for anyone who has ever employed with, or worked with, or had their butt saved by, or argued with, laughed with, cried with, and anyone in general who's ever depended on a vet nurse. Hands up if that's you. Thought so. I'd love for this conversation to help open your eyes to the possibilities and the talent and the passion that is right under your nose, and to give you some ideas of what that talent is capable of and how you can help to steer it. But it sure as hell is also an episode for nurses and for techs. If you're a nurse and you're listening to this, then first off, we love you, we appreciate you, and second, I challenge you as a nurse to listen to this and not feel the desire to find new ways to extend yourself and to make even more of a difference. Ken's story is a real eye-opener about what is possible for someone with the right drive if they are in the right environment that can accommodate that drive. There's never been a better time than now. It is a new era, and this conversation with Ken will show you what the future of vet nursing can be. Please enjoy Ken Yagi. I'm Hubert Hinstra.
I'm Gerardo Poli.
And this is The Vet Vault. Ken Yagi, welcome to The Vet Vault.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so thrilled to talk to you. We've had a few people from your team on the podcast already, and they've all been really interesting discussions, all really passionate people, obviously. This one's a bit different, though, because we're talking about nurses. Even though this is a podcast aimed at vets generally, I do really hope that we have techs and nurses listening to this and that they get something out of this, because they are, you are, I think, a very neglected
is more of a word, I think, a bit of a neglected group in the profession. There's a lot of focus on veterinary well-being and the vet careers and how do we make it sustainable. But then there's this massive group of the backbone of many hospitals, really, that get a little bit neglected. And it's a bit sad because they're incredible people and they have careers as well. And it's so exciting for me to come across your profile and look at your work to go, well, there's somebody who is pushing that word career, you know, not just the support team or something like that, actually people with career who want to go places. And then you as an example of how do you take this career, taking it to the next level. So I'm thrilled to be talking to you. Now, let's start with I gave you a heads up about this one, a bad decisions question. I was driving along a road and I saw graffiti on a wall that said, bad decisions lead to good stories. Which made me think a little bit. And I want to know, do you think that's true? And if so, do you have an example of a story that fits with that?
I'm sure it's true. There must be really good stories out of bad decisions. And I kind of thought, like, you know, well, it's probably also that it's not always, because bad decisions sometimes lead to really bad stories, but some of it's true. I guess I thought about my own example that I started out actually going to vet school thinking that I was going to be a veterinarian. But I ended up not following through with all that. I thought of this as sort of like was it a bad decision for me to decide to move away by myself into one of the hardest programs out there to go through with no support structure? Or was it a bad decision to, when it came to it, not sticking it out and pursuing that degree? Maybe that's a bad decision. But it certainly led to finding my place and path in veterinary medicine as a veterinary nurse, educator, advocate, walking alongside all the leaders paving the way for the next generations to come. So I think it is still a good story.
That's interesting. So you'll often get, I've met several stories that are different in people that do nursing first and then go, oh, I think I'm going to go do vet and then do the vet thing. But you did it the other way around. Why the decision to just not do vet in the end, Ken?
Man, that's a hard question because back then, this is like over 20 years ago now. Mm-hmm. I was in vet school. I felt like going to our classroom that we spent the most time in was in the basement. So walking down into the basement, spending time in this box of a classroom, listening to all the lectures, hitting the books, and trying to take in all the academic information behind it didn't click with me as much as the job that I had at the time working at the medical genetics colony, working with animals. And so the direct hands-on animal work was a lot more satisfying, at least in that moment. And I think it's also that once I stopped going to school and went back into work as a veterinary assistant, there was a moment where a now friend, mentor of mine visited the practice to give us a little bit of continuing education. And the way that I was introduced to her was that the owner brought her into the lunchroom where I was at, and he came in and said, oh, and here's the guy that used to be in vet school, but now he works as a tech. And that was like one of the most embarrassing ways to be introduced. I wanted to disappear in the moment. But Nancy, who is the friend and mentor, just kind of looked at me and said, well, do you like it? And that was kind of like the flip of the switch for me, where that question was, the answer to that question immediately was, yeah, I do. Like, this is what I like to do. And so I think that I realized that there's a lot more to veterinary medicine than just being a vet. And there's a lot more care that the patients need. And I've certainly created my own career out of it. And so no regrets here.
That's cool. It's a brave decision, isn't it? Because there is, our last episode was sort of hinted at the decision that, well, at the topic that a lot of people do stuff, including a vet degree, because of external perceptions, or it's a status thing. I've got to do this thing. And actually, they just want to work with animals. They don't need to have the high status. They just want to work with animals. I love that you had the courage to go, yeah, this isn't for me. I have a passion and I'm going to do this other thing. And I love that you like it so much. How did the animal thing happen? It sounds, because even before you did vet, you said you worked in a what was the animal related job that you mentioned before you went to vet school?
That was when I was in vet school, that I worked at the medical genetics colony as a part-time job as I was in school.
Okay, cool. And then before that, the career in animals, how did, what was 10-year-old Ken like and what was he doing?
So taking a little bit further from 10 years old, but in high school, there was a point in time where I thought that I came to a sudden realization that I'm a junior in high school. I need to think about whether I'm going to go to college or not. What am I going to do for life? And I had no plans at that point in time. Mm. So I had to quickly think about what I was going to do. When you mentioned the status thing, it's pretty interesting because my thought process was that people who are from my background or my culture very much revere people who go into medicine and become a doctor. And that's a status thing. So, you know, that was definitely a thought process that I had, that is that something that I want to be pursuing? And at the same time, I thought, well, I'm a huge introvert, by the way. And I thought to myself, I don't like people very much. And so maybe human medicine isn't where I want to go. What about veterinary medicine? It was kind of a little bit like on a whim like that. But once I started pursuing it, I really found my passion here.
That's so interesting. That sounds very similar to my story. A lot of the people we interview here say, yeah, from the time I was five, I knew I was going to be a vet or work with animals. I didn't have that at all. Mine was the similar thing, lost in high school, going, oh, I don't know what to do. Should I do an engineer? Should I do an IT? And again, looking, well, I do well at school. I should probably do some sort of a degree. And I liked animals, and it was a similar thing. But the reason I want to pause here is I do sometimes think that people who are and I've seen this more in my, not on the podcast so much, more with people you work with, people who have that lifelong passion and desire to do it, and they have this preconceived idea of what a life in vet science is going to look like. Often, I feel like they sometimes struggle more with the transition to reality, whereas you get people who sort of fall into vet profession as an aside, you know, it's not a lifelong passion. It's just, well, something tickles their fancy and they go, well, let me go and explore that. Often cope a lot better. Have you come across that at all? Is that total bullshit?
That's a good question. Like, it's not something that's hit me specifically, but now that you mentioned it, I'm going to look for it and see what that story sound like. I think for me, even though I came in feeling like maybe I don't like people and that's why I want to do veterinary medicine and animals are what I want to focus on, now it's very much about the people that I've met along the way that have guided me through the process, pointed me in the right directions, give me just a little bit of a nudge to go in the direction that I would be good at, but letting me make the decision ultimately is where I found my path. And that all leads back to helping people through helping pets.
I love that. Didn't like people. Thought I'll work with animals. That old foolish mistake of thinking a career in veterinary science will allow you not to work with people. That's a common misconception. And then he becomes, well, I have to come back to the introvert thing, but then he becomes a speaker, trainer, and his career is all about people. That's just a kind of an irony in that story there, isn't there? Well, let's look at that now. Now you're a world-class speaker, you train people, you run people as an introvert. How did that happen? How did you transition or learn how to not let your introversion be a stumbling block for you?
When I think back on my career, I definitely started working as a veterinary assistant. When I met Nancy was when, after that conversation, she said, well, if you like what you're doing, get yourself credentialed. And then the next step was there's something called VTS certification if you want to be specialized in emergency and critical care. And there was another moment where the next time she came out to give us a little bit of continuing education, we had a conversation. I was talking to her about a case, a horrible like pulmonary edema case. We know those cases where the serosanguineous fluid just comes out the airway and we have to dump the patient and things like that. And as I was talking to her about that case, she said, hey, why don't you think about doing your case report at IVEX, which is the annual emergency conference. And it's just a short, 12-minute presentation. It's going to be in front of a panel of judges and some audience and those kinds of things. And I think my response to that was, shoot, like, I don't know if I could do something like that and never thought of it. And it was more that I didn't even realize that was an option, like that was out there. But that's another one of those nudges that she gave me to try something new, give it a shot. And I remember right up to the moment of going up to the podium and starting to speak, I was thinking to myself, why did I sign up for this? Like, why did I agree to this?
Seems like such a good idea at the time, doesn't it? Until about an hour before, you're like,
yep. Once I started talking about the case and sharing the situation and the knowledge that goes into it and the care that we provided and all that. And afterwards, I felt like, wow, like this was great. I want to do more of this. And that's where she came to me and said that, hey, you did a good job. I'm going to recommend you to come back next year to do a presentation. And that's where my speaking career started. And it just snowballed from there because she did say, but be careful because it can snowball very quickly and you need to make sure you pace yourself. And that's exactly what had happened there, I think.
Amazing stuff. I'm very curious. I won't turn this into a clinical podcast. The case you talked about with the fluid gushing out. Did it survive? Is that why we're talking about it?
That particular patient did not survive. Yeah, okay. It was a pretty bad congestive heart failure case.
Yeah, I was going to say, when they get to that, they don't generally do all that well.
But the case report that I did present on was a patient that was hit by a car, had a diaphragmatic hernia, and a liver torsion on top of that, which we didn't know at the time. And so through the stabilization that we provided in the time that it took for us to go into surgery, the liver probably had irreversible damage that we couldn't help the patient through. And so it was a hit by car diaphragmatic hernia that turned into liver failure in a hospitalization period that we actually ultimately couldn't save either. But there's a lot of care that goes into it. And there's also a story with the family there that was told too. So,
wow. Okay. All right, we'll have to get you back for clinical stuff another time because I get curious immediately. Now, you mentioned that nudge, you've had those several nudges in the right direction. So I'd love this to be a nudge, a massive nudge for a lot of people and get some, because I'm oblivious to some of the stuff when I researched you, you know, credentialed. Let's start with that. And I want to get to the specialist nursing stuff as well. I didn't even know that was a thing. I'm embarrassed to say. So what does credentialed mean in your world?
Yeah, it means different things around the world. And so I'll just generalize this process. But at least in the United States, there's a process where people can go through a 2-year degree or a 4-year degree, associate's or bachelor's degree in veterinary technology or nursing. And that qualifies them to take the national examination called the VTNE. And then in each of the states, they're able to credential. And we call it credential blanket-wise because sometimes it's state-governed as registration, licensure, or certification. Or sometimes it's a private organization that issues certification that doesn't have any legal regulation, but it's a certification that shows that people have met the qualifications. And that's existing throughout all states of the United States now. 40 states have state-governed regulations, and 10 states still have private regulation. And so if you take a look at around the world, it's similar in that there's some form of an educational degree associated with a qualification examination process that gets regulated by either governmental agency or a private organization that certifies them in the knowledge.
Okay. So when you say credential, do you mean an official qualification versus starting as a 17-year-old on shift and somebody just showing you the ropes on how to, is that basically what it comes down to? Okay. We in Australia, in the last year or so, we've suddenly got a qualification, a degree that is a vet tech degree as well, which is new. And people are curious about what that's going to mean to the nurses and how it's going to change their training. And it seems to be a lot more theory than the old qualifications had, whereas the old qualification was very practical. And again, there's questions around from vets even to go, well, are they going to be better nurses? And they've got a lot more theoretical knowledge, but do they maybe miss out on some practical stuff? I don't know. What's your thought on that? What's the benefit of more theoretical knowledge for a tech or for a nurse?
Yeah, actually, that's a really good question. It always comes up is if people were to ask the question of which is more important, education or experience, that's a very tough question to answer because you can't do without either of them. And you need both, it feels like. But when we think about where veterinary nursing has come in the sense of what kind of role do we play? We have a lot of patient assessment, physical exams that we do, pieces of information that we need to put together, whether it's different kinds of heart sounds, lung sounds, or the heart rate sped up. Why is that? Along with some of the advanced procedures that we perform, placing central lines, mechanically ventilating animals, putting them under anesthesia, which is a very commonplace, doesn't have to be a critical care situation. Every veterinary practice has anesthesia involved, and there are veterinary nurses that administer it. There's so much physiology, pharmacology, you name it, like any kind of those disciplines that people do need knowledge on in order for them to provide the best care possible, be able to be prepared for some of the issues that arise, to respond to it appropriately and make sure that the patient receives the care that they need. And some of that can be filled with experience and self-learning. But I think having a baseline knowledge through education is very important.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that for sure. Makes a lot of sense. And then the specialist thinking, what does it look like to get there? Like, what's the process? What can you specialize in? Multiple questions. What can you specialize in? What does it look like time commitment-wise in that? And what has it meant for you in your career?
There is the National Association of Veterinary Technicians in America, NAVTA, that is based in the U.S. that has a committee on veterinary technician specialties. They recognize the veterinary technician, veterinary nurse specialty areas. And so there's different academies that get established that provide certification for it. And so you're going to make me look this up because I don't know all 16 of them.
Oh, no. All right. So there's a heap. Okay. So it's not just, okay. So there's multiple. No, you don't have to list them all.
But there's, 16 specialties that have been recognized so far. Emergency and critical care was the first one that was recognized, but there's definitely also dentistry, internal medicine, anesthesia and analgesia, clinical practice, and even laboratory animals, behavior, clinical pathology. So there's all sorts of specialties out there, and there are the recognized specialties, and there's 16 of them, but there are also specialty areas that people are going into that don't have an academy established yet, but maybe in the future that'll be a specialty certification as well.
And then what did that process look? Because you've done two, you've done DCC and medicine, is that right?
Yes.
Which one was first?
Emergency and critical care was first.
Why did you do the medicine on top of that as well?
Yeah. Okay. Good question. I think that when I started in my career, I first went through the process of how can I make myself the best nurse possible? How can I help my patients best? And so that was the get myself credentialed first. So then I got my RVT in California. And then when I thought of what's next, what do I do next? That's where the VTS in ECC came up. I did that since that's directly in the area of my work. And then I thought to myself, what's next? And I think that's the kind of the question that I've asked myself each time is, how can I better myself from here? And that's where another VTS was one way to go, and actually maybe the only way that I knew at the time. And internal medicine and emergency and critical care has so much overlap. I ran the blood bank. There were a lot of critical cases that was based on internal medicine, like IMHA or diabetes, for example. And so I qualified for internal medicine. And so I went forward and did the VTS in internal medicine. And then after that, when I thought, what's next? It was kind of hard to find what would be my career advancing step next in the clinical pathway. And I did eventually go through a master's program in veterinary sciences. And so I feel like I gained a lot of advanced clinical knowledge, but also thinking a little bit more into evidence-based practice and what does evidence look like out there, literature, how to conduct clinical studies. And so I gained a little bit on that end as well. But to your question, it's just basically the mindset of how do I make myself better at what I do was what led me to get to VTSs.
What I like about your story is that you had this drive and it actually led to really cool places. Because maybe a couple of years ago, even 5 years ago, the cynic in me would say, all right, so you're going to do all this training and you're going to get so shit out at your job. It'll be fantastic for your patients. But beyond that, kind of so what? Because if you're stuck in a clinic somewhere and there's a ceiling, and I think that's often a concern for techs and for nurses, is a perceived ceiling in the careers. So yeah, I can qualify myself better, but so what? Am I going to be in the same clinic for the same pay, just much better at my job? But then I look at your career and I go, well, the profession's clearly changing because the ceiling is disappearing. Is that how you feel? Did you ever feel like that? Did you kind of get stuck in the same thing, or did you always see a pathway through there?
Probably somewhere in the middle there, that I definitely did feel like once I obtained my VTS certification and being really good at what I do, the next step wasn't as clear. And that's why I said, you know, the next thing that I did was the master's program, but it didn't gain me too much in terms of the clinical setting. That's where my career path started to diverge a little bit more out into things like I did a 3 years of being an instructor at the community college nearby to be an instructor for a veterinary technology program. So I went into education a little bit. I became the supervisor of the ICU, one of the supervisors of the ICU, co-manager of the ICU, the sole manager of the ICU, and then a part of the leadership team of that little. And so I kind of went up the management side of things as well. And I went out and started my speaking career. And so that was a way to share my knowledge. And that was another thing that I could do. But to your point, if a person wanted to stay in the clinical setting and continue growing and doing more and more, it's very hard to find that path that makes it a sustainable career unless you're in the right place. And so that ceiling is definitely there. And that's why we're today talking about things like, what does a nurse practitioner role look like in veterinary medicine? Can we have another step in our career going from being a VTS and a great technician or nurse and playing a physician's assistant or nurse practitioner-like role? Because that would be somebody who can stay in the clinics and continue to grow.
What's the situation like in the US? I saw a discussion locally the other day. Somebody was talking about the obvious solution for the vet shortage or the staff shortage in the vet profession is to utilize some sort of a nurse practitioner or other roles who can offload some of the doing of veterinarians, shift it to other roles so that we can do more sort of overseeing roles. But the stumbling block in Australia, at least, is regulation. It's pretty tightly regulated as to who can do what procedures are. Do you guys have the same issue there, or is it, and is it changing? Are you guys working to change that?
I think we're very much in the discussion and debate phase on that. That in the US, it's probably similar, that licensed veterinarians are the only ones that legally can diagnose, prescribe, perform surgery. So in order for somebody else to be able to do any of those tasks that qualify as those categories, the laws would need to change in order for that to happen. And so there's still room, though, for us to veterinary nurses to be utilized in a much higher level that's right up to that line of it being illegal. We don't want to do anything illegal. That's not what we're saying. But until the laws change, we still have room for us to utilize our nursing team members much better than we do today. So that's one thing that we should be working on today, right now, and everyone should be doing that. But going forward, if we want to have an expanded career path, this is an option that people are talking about, looking at, and there's master's degrees being established to take a look at what advanced education, higher education looks like for veterinary nurses so that they are equipped to do so. Maybe there's some conversations about, could there be a certification process that certifies that advanced knowledge? And then once that comes into play, is there regulation changes that could happen that establishes this role in a legislative way? And just thinking about that progression, that discussion started, I think that everyone's trying to gather as much information about this to make a sound decision. Is one thing that I worry about with the establishment of this role is, if we're just talking about and thinking about this as a way to bring more people in to fill the shortage of veterinary professionals and bringing in people who might be outside of the nursing field, for example, somebody who has a science degree, maybe has worked in a veterinary practice for a little bit, and then qualifies to be this practitioner that can diagnose, prescribe, or perform some surgery. While that meets the requirement or like the desire of bringing in more people who can provide veterinary care, it doesn't really help expand on the nursing career side. I'd like it to be a pathway that's established for experienced nurses to continue moving through their career into higher practice is what I'd like to see. And so I just want to make sure that this is implemented in a very careful way so that it doesn't serve as a way to bring in another set of professionals that is seen as higher than veterinary nurses that suppresses the growth of our profession.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, so it's the way to go, but it's not a quick fix. It's not going to solve our problem tomorrow. Regulation change is a slow journey, isn't it? In the short term, you mentioned underutilizing our techs and our nurses, which I think is a big issue. Are there things that you see in practice when you go out to practices or even in your career? What are the key things that jump out at you where you go, you fools, why aren't you using your techs better for this? Where are we underutilizing our nurses and techs at the moment?
There's a good amount of that. Okay, so just to put it into context, I'd say maybe a little bit of time ago, a year ago or so, there's a survey that's out there that's used as a tool. People can just say, how often does this particular task be performed by a veterinary assistant, credentialed veterinary technician, or veterinarian? And then we kind of scored that responses, and we saw that there was maybe only about 36% of what we think veterinary nurses could be doing out there that was said to be having done by veterinary nurses out there, which is a pretty low percentage. And I'd say that, I did this with Heather Prendergast and Aaron Spencer. We have high standards. We have a lot of things that we think we should be able to do. And so maybe we're overshooting a little bit, but even with that in mind, 36% of our potential is pretty low. And so there's a lot of room for us to grow in our utilization. So if there are people who practices out there that are having veterinarians be the ones that are placing IV catheters, for example, or inducing anesthesia, monitoring anesthesia, providing inpatient care, the people who can assess the patients are also veterinarians only. That's the kind of stuff that are very low-hanging fruits that, you know, veterinary nurses already should be doing. And if you're not doing that, you're clearly not being an efficient team. But there are probably other things. And so at VEG over here, we're trying to establish a set of things that's still within the scope of practice and within the laws, but very advanced. This, like, what if we could have our veterinary nurses being the ones that unblock cats when they come in for emergencies? What if they're the ones that can drive endoscopic foreign body, like endoscopic GI foreign body removal that doesn't require surgery? And so there's all sorts of different kinds of things that we can consider advanced AFAS, TFAS exams that normally, quote unquote, normally veterinarians are the ones.
Traditionally done by veterinarians.
Traditionally, that's a good word, but done by veterinarians that likely can be done by a nurse, a well-trained one that has the trust of the entire team that they can do this appropriately without causing or posing a increased risk of complications occurring. You know, that's a role that we could play. And so could we push people more and more up into that advanced task and also the thinking work that is involved in patient care?
It makes so much sense because the things you mentioned there, none of them are, you know, a massive. You don't need a hell of a lot of theoretical background to be able to drive an endoscope or to shove a tube up a cat's penis. It's a skill thing. So you can explain it. Anybody can learn it. My only reservation, and I think maybe this is why it happens, is the things you mentioned are fun things to do. So I don't, as a vet, I don't want to give them up. I want to do it.
Right. Yeah. No, it certainly doesn't mean that the veterinarian can't do that. But if it's a situation where you are either in, like, you know, the surgery room doing a splenectomy for a splenic mass rupture, a hemoabdomen, and you have a blocked cat that needs to be unblocked at the same time, who's doing it? That kind of
thing. Yeah. Makes a lot of sense. I really do like that. How do you teach that? Have you come, and I have a bigger question I'll come back to, but teaching and training takes in practice. That's your job, isn't it? That's a large part of your, or has been, and is it still a part of figuring out how to train? Have you figured out specific techniques or ways that resonate well, that's a good way of teaching techs in clinic, or things that don't work, for example?
One of the things that commonly happens that we know doesn't work, at least very well, is just throwing information at people. This is the kind of thing where you stand up in front of the room and you have a group of people and you're giving a lecture and you're just throwing information at them. And this is maybe where the recovery initiative comes in, is that there's a certification process for veterinary CPR out there that has very much embraced the way of creating opportunity for people to put knowledge into practice and learning through that instead. So it's an online course first, get all the knowledge aspect through this nice, interactive, more modern online course that people can learn the knowledge from. And then the next step is to go into an in-person workshop where we use simulation in order to have people actually perform CPR on this dog dummy that is able to create heart and lung sounds, pulses, and it detects compressions and breaths and things like that. It has a software that shows a multi-parameter monitor. You can take a look at the ECG, what the end-tidal CO2 value is. And so then after they do that, if they do things well and they go according to the algorithm that we're trying to teach, they can bring the animal back. And if it doesn't go so well, they might lose the animal. But this is kind of like the, you know, simulated high stakes that we create. And so then people really try their best and they learn from it. And after that, it's the facilitated discussion where we create a safe environment for people to answer questions, have a discussion, and learn from each other. That makes it stick even more. So creating a place for people to apply their knowledge and practice, first of all, and then the debriefing after it is really makes it what makes it stick in their minds. And hopefully they leave the session feeling more confident. There's also an assessment that's associated with it. So they get tested at the end to perform CPR along the algorithm. and they pass or fail, right? And so that's really an accomplishment after they come through that and they actually pass. And I see people like high-fiving each other and like cheering and like giving each other hugs or exchanging information to say, hey, like, let's keep in touch. And so I think it really creates a great learning environment in that kind of way. So I really like that kind of setup. In everything that we're training now, we're trying to incorporate a very similar model where we give a little bit of pre-work for knowledge, give them an opportunity to practice it, and then test them in some kind of way.
Teach a little, do a lot, debrief, test. That's the recipe, is it? That's the winning recipe. Quick interruption. Two things. Vetveld Live, baby. 22 to 25 November, Noosa. 2 days of clinical content with Prof. Jill Madison and Prof. David Church, the oracles of Smalley's medicine. But this is not your average conference. We're going full Vet Vault. This means that our clinical content will be less lecture, more interactive. Lots of questions, interviews, case studies. Yeah, you're going to learn a few things, but what we really want to learn is how to think better. And then there's the non-clinical stuff. We're kayaking in a World Heritage site. We're doing yoga on the beach. We're surfing. We're hiking. We're climbing a mountain. We're doing cooking classes. Definitely a fair bit of eating. My favorite ice cream shop is across the road from our venue for day two, which also happens to be across the road from the beach. And on the last day, we are doing a 4-hour session with Philip McKernan from episode 70. It is going to be epic. I'll put a link for the full event in the episode description, but don't book there. Email us at vetveldpodcast@gmail.com and tell us that you heard about it here and we'll send you a Vetveld listener discount code. Thing number two, our Vetveld clinical subscribers already know about this conference and a bunch of them have already booked. And what's more, they are almost certainly a few steps ahead of most vets on the knowledge front when it comes to our topics for the conference, which is endocrinology conundrums and clinical reasoning. This is because they've already listened to hours of amazing content with our two conference guests on our medicine podcast, plus around 80 plus hours and counting of other medicine, surgery, and emergency and critical care content. They're a smart bunch, our subscribers, and they're getting even smarter, which is why we call them our Vetveld nerds. You should be a nerd. Check it out for free for 2 weeks at vvn.supercast.com. How, just as an aside, did the whole recover thing stall? Because you have that practical component, did it stall during COVID or did you manage to take it offline or what happened with it?
It certainly did slow down quite a bit during COVID. There was some effort put into modifying the simulation software so that it can be done remotely. But before that really started to become implemented and, you know, took off as a mode of teaching, we're now more in person these days. So we've seen a sudden rise more recently in the number of workshops that's being held. But we're now focusing on training more instructors out there so that they can go and do the workshops and we'll hopefully have a more exponential effect in getting that out there.
And do you find the in-person is still the, and having done both ways, is it still the ideal way to do it in general?
In terms of the focus on the learning and the quality of learning, that's the ideal way to do it. In terms of reach and how widespread this information can be, having a remote method of being able to teach that would be definitely better in terms of reach. But there probably is some compromise to the quality of learning.
Your journey again, Ken, and how far you've gone and your drive. Well, first of all, what drives you? Was it just purely a desire to see how, you said it earlier, how good can I get? Like, how can I be the best at what I do?
I think that what I call like my defining moment or what really defined why I'm doing this is actually my wife and I's experience with our first daughter. She's not with us anymore, but we experienced being in the NICU and the pediatric ICU, the healthcare that we received, and the way that nurses played such a large role in that and how they made us feel as the entire team really made me consider how veterinary medicine is conducted and what veterinary nursing looks like compared to human nursing. And there was so much positive elements of that that made me feel like there's a lot to be done on the veterinary nursing side. That, for example, it was a situation where we were brought into the NICU and hospitalized. And the first thing that the nurses said to us was, hey, you know, I know that you had books that you probably wanted to read to her, music that you wanted her to listen to. Just bring it all in, come in anytime you want, just be with her and spend time as a family. And that was an example of how, regardless of how this was going to end up, and they don't know how it was going to end up, or maybe they did, I don't know, that they were focused on not only the patient, but the entire family. And I feel like that could be a missing piece in many veterinary practices out there. I won't say all of them, but many of them, that we focus so much on the animal and how we can take care of the patient themselves, so not really pay attention to what we might be allowing the owners to experience, the family members to experience. And so I think that that is something that I bring into my everyday thought process as the chief veterinary nursing officer. What is veterinary nursing? What does that look like? And how can we function better to take care of not only the pet, but the people through them?
Yeah, there's a big contrast there, isn't it? You're dead right. At most vet practices, it's kind of the opposite of that. So it's not, instead of including the families, we almost want to keep them out. We're like, well, you're irritating us while we do our work. Stop interfering. We're working here. Just don't be so annoying, sort of an attitude. I know it's not expressed, but it's often felt, or it's often how the vibe is on the floor. But I know why it happens. And we talked about it with David as well. You are trying to concentrate and having, it feels like it's an extra emotional drain or a distraction almost to the work that you want to do. Do you find that is the case? Or like, how do you combine the caring and the open side with the people who come attached to your patient with still being focused and working hard and not feeling like it's a distraction?
So even before I came to Veg, I was working at a place that was an open hospital. So we allowed the pet owners to come to the back with their pets, watch surgery, watch the dentistry procedure, stay in the ICU, things like that. And Veg also is a very open, taking it to the next level open concept where people walk directly into the treatment room and they're there the entire time. So definitely, you know, it immediately puts people on guard when they hear this story, because they think about, well, what if they get in the way? Or what if they see things that they shouldn't see? What if the animal cries out in pain when we're trying to place a catheter and the owner's right there? And so there's so many things that could go wrong with this that immediately worry people. But that's where I think that we need to be very mindful of, if the animal is crying out in pain and struggling and you're having to wrestle that animal to place an IV catheter, what's wrong with that picture? Is it the fact that the owners are there, or is it that we're not handling the animal in the right way? Maybe is there like some way that we can place the IV catheter without it being painful? Is there local anesthetics, like cream that we should be using? There's different ways to deal with that kind of situation that is probably more friendly to the patient who we're trying to help and the family that comes attached with them. And so I think it's kind of changing our mindset a little bit on what's the true issue here? What's the core issue that we need to solve, instead of just keeping people out of the way so that they don't experience any of the bad things that are happening? So let's fix those bad things.
I think the resistance, if I think about myself, because it's extra thinking, because now I've got to think about what else should I be doing rather than just power through, which means extra steps, which feels annoying. But I think the main thing is the shift of mind. The mind shift is, it's a hard thing to do. People don't change their minds easily and not without resistance. I've tried. I am trying where I work. We're not an open clinic officially, but since chatting to David and to Mariana and everybody, trying to be more open to say to people, I'll come through. I do still feel the extra pressure. Feel like it is that feeling of being watched, and you know, you don't hit the IV first go. I struggle with it a bit, but I do see the benefits as well. I'm still going to have to see one of your hospitals and see it in action.
Come visit any time. Come visit any time. But just thinking about, like, even though you say that, though, I guess that if you take a look at your everyday practice, there are things that are open, as in like you do things in front of the owners, like some things, right? So it's not like everything's shut behind the door. And so what are those things? Why do you feel comfortable doing that? What's the next step? Because you don't have to go all the way from how you currently practice to completely open like Veg is, because that's a huge transition. What's the next step that you could take? If you're already drawing blood in front of them in the exam room, then it's the next step that you can actually place an IV catheter in front of them. Or is it that you can have them swing by and watch part of the surgery through the windows real quick and just say, hey, so this is what's going on, and have the owners be at least content seeing that things are being taken care of? Not every owner wants to see surgery, by the way. Like, they don't want to see their...
Yeah, like, yeah, fair enough.
cut open or anything like that. But anyways, that might be one way where it's just a short-term duration that it's a check-in and that's all it is. And so there's ways to gradually increase your openness, I think, but having your team on board with it, having a plan in place to make that happen is what I tend to recommend when people say, how do we get there? Because I think this is a good idea. It's just so hard to change the culture. It's, you know, obviously involving your team and taking gradual steps and agreeing upon doing things. We know that it's not going to be perfect the first time that you do it for every single situation, but learning from that and going forward from there. Because I'll say that survey studies say this too, and I experienced it from the people that we work with, that even people who were skeptical about this, once they're in that environment, they do it for a while, they see the benefits of it, how the relationship between the owner and the veterinary team is so much better. They see the value. They don't complain about like the fees because they see the value in what you're doing, and they're actually seeing how hard you guys are working and the facility, how it's set up and all that you can be proud of. Vast majority of the people who come into this environment learn to love it.
All right. I believe you. As you say, it's a slow process. Right, let's do something specifically for the nurses and the techs out there. If you had a younger sibling or a cousin or one of your kids said to you, I want to do vet tech, I want to do it, what would you tell them at the start of their career that you think will make a big difference for them? Because I'll tell you why. 10 years ago, so my slightly older brother lives in the United Kingdom. And he was a bit frustrated with his job and that. And he said to me, he's considering doing vet nursing. And I have to be honest, I didn't encourage it. I was like, you can do it. It's a great job. But you've got to really, really love it. You've got to be sure that you're going to love this because you're going to work really hard. It's really emotional work. It's funny, thankless work at times, depending on where you work. Pay is a bit rubbish. It's really, we can talk about pay as well. And so I was pretty harsh on the job, even though I absolutely respect and adore vet nurses. And I don't know if it's because of what I said to him or where they looked into it, but in the end, he didn't end up doing it. And I don't know, was it the right advice? Because I look at you and I go, oh, wow, I can be wrong. There's definitely pathways there. What would you suggest to somebody like that?
I think that definitely people have asked me that question of, would you recommend your kids to go into this profession? And I gave a pause before I could answer that most of the time, because I couldn't wholeheartedly say, oh yeah, this is amazing and you, like, everyone should do it. Because it does take a special kind of person to thrive in this profession, at least up to, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, I would maybe say that. I think things are changing and there's a lot of optimism that we all have of where this profession is headed. And so one of the biggest things that I would say is make sure that whatever you're doing is something that you can find meaning in, and that this is something that fills your cup. Is it true? And for me, that turned into the realization that it's not only the patient that you save. That, you know, I said that I used to think that I was in veterinary nursing because I didn't like people, but now I know that I do it for both people and the pets. And so as nurses, the care that we provide, the compassion that we embody, the warmth that we show affect both pets and their people. And so people should be definitely treated with dignity, respect, kindness, like human beings. And just consider that when pets have an emergency or they need care from the veterinarian, then their people are coming in sick too. And it's our responsibility to treat all of them together. So like when the pet owners actually know that their pet received the best care possible by the best nurses out there, and they were given the best chance of getting better, even if the outcome isn't what they wanted it to be, you're making a huge impact on their lives to be able to accept what happened. And so it's really not only the patients that you save in your daily work. And if you can be proud of that and how much good you're doing every single day, then you're in the right profession.
I like your optimism. You said the word there, you're optimistic, because we hear a lot of, at the moment, a lot of things about the profession in crisis. Why are you optimistic?
I think that I am very optimistic because I'm lucky enough to sit here at the seat of the executive team at this company. I'm the chief veterinary nursing officer. There's not, at least in the US, not any more of those seats out there right now, but that sparked discussion. There are more that are going to be created, and I'm hearing murmurs of that, which is great. And that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to challenge the rest of the field to make similar changes. Now I get to oversee nursing for this entire company and making different kinds of changes, like the pay scale changes that we made, where we asked ourselves, how do we pay our veterinary nurses like human nurses? And we're very darn close. And so we can provide a career for people. And that's creating ripple effects around the industry that everyone is responding to that too. And I'm sure that there were many companies that were already thinking about doing things like that to make it a sustainable career. But the focus that we have on our profession and the fact that this is a team-based approach that we have, team-based care that we're providing to meet the demands of the patients out there, it's just leading to more and more changes. And I think maybe I'm a little bit biased in that I'm in a place where I feel like I have a lot more control of what kinds of changes that can be made, at least within my reach. And there might be people who feel like they're more helpless because they don't have a voice and they're not being heard. And that's one of the issues that we have out there and one of the major reasons why people leave the field. Yeah. But I think that's why I encourage people to, within their reach, what's within their control to make the positive changes? And are you starting to see effects of that change? And I am. And maybe that's why I am so optimistic.
It's so good to have examples like you or mentors like you of people using that voice saying, well, I deserve something more with my career. Because I see that, and I don't know if it's a hard thing to discuss without potentially offending a group of people, but you know, this incredible, I love nurses. I mean, I've 20 years of being babysat and supported by nurses. They're some of my favorite people. It's the most hardworking, giving, self-sacrificing. You know, they spend their lives wrestling animals, trying to help them when the animals don't always want to be helped, and it's things with claws and teeth, and they get bitten and bodily excretions all over them, and they just keep doing it, and they're so positive and such incredible people. And I wouldn't say underappreciated, they're appreciated, but that appreciation is not always shown, and it's not, they're not valued in terms of, we talk about money again, and not thanked enough, I think, for what they do. But then hardly ever do you see nurses also stand up for themselves and say, look, I want more. Where's the next level? I deserve more. And I don't just mean money, as you say, a career pathway, a future or something, rather than going, well, I've done this for 5 years. Nothing's changing. I'm out. I'm going to go get an office job somewhere, which is really sad because you have people with such a love for what they do. And that's why they're attracted to the job. Is that a personality style? I know that I've heard discussions about classically vet nursing attracts people who, like you say, who avoid people who find comfort in animals and maybe don't have the, I don't know, say people skills again. I'm trying not to offend anybody, but I'm trying to get to something helpful. But they don't have that drive to say, well, I'm going to put my hand up and put myself out there. Is that something that you found throughout your career or still find, or something that you find as a challenge?
I'm not offended because I'm socially awkward, but and I recognize that. Yeah, in terms of advocating for themselves, do we see that our profession has a harder time advocating for ourselves? I think traditionally, I would think so. Like, I think I agree with that. But with that said, there's a shift here that when I talk to some of my colleagues who are in education that are literally guiding the future generation of our profession to go out into the field, there are many of them that are saying something like, don't accept anything less than this many dollars per hour in this area, for example, and providing guidance and providing information regarding how to build a better resume, how to negotiate your salary in an interview process, or how to do the interviews better to begin with, you know, those kinds of things. And so I think that there's a lot more focus on the skill sets that we need aside from just medical, nursing, and patient care knowledge that is coming into play that is starting to change that a little bit. So I think that I just always am so appreciative of all the different facets that leaders in this field are working on to help better the profession overall. And we're seeing that even though it's gradual change that we're seeing the changes happening.
Yeah, maybe it's not a personality change. It's a cultural change. It's about having role models and seeing, look, hey, there is a different way. It doesn't have to be this way.
I think the word cultural change definitely resonates because there is a certain culture of veterinary medicine that we have lived with, and that's starting to change.
Yeah, more people like you, more conversations like these. In the training and the work that you do or your career so far, what do you see with vet techs or vet nurses that drives you crazy? Do you see behaviors from vets or from nurses or anything that you go, no, this could be so much better?
Yeah, and I won't set myself aside for this because I think it's me included. But I think that the thing that I feel is most detrimental with how we're approaching things is being reactive. Meaning that if we see something that happens that we don't agree with, sometimes it's anger or frustrations that come out instead of looking for how do we work together to solve this issue. And you see that very often out in social media these days, where there's often very much emotionally charged debates and arguments that are going on. And it happening in the internet space, the social media space, that doesn't really go any further than that. Maybe it's making a difference as people read it and process it, and they're doing what they can do to help change those kinds of things within their reach. But it's that latter part that really needs to be the main mode in order for us to make real change. So I think that's one thing that I want people to focus more on, is that energy that goes into the anger can be directed to making the change, and everyone has something that they can do within their reach, regardless of what position you're in or what kind of status that you might have.
How do you change that reactiveness? Because I agree with you, that is, it's that emotional reaction and then saying or speaking or doing without, before thinking it through. Have you found ways to get better at that?
I think I'm learning.
Yeah. Is it just an age and wisdom thing?
Age and wisdom. Yeah. I don't know if it just takes time or more experiences. I think one thing that I can say about that is you can't learn through that process until you start trying. So if you stop at being angry about something and feeling that something needs to change, but you don't act on it, you're not going to be able to find the way in which that change actually happens. And so that's why I say, like, you know, unless you try something, find out more information about what's going on. How does a change like legislative change, for example, happen? And work with people who are trying to make the same change, try it out, get some learning going, and then based on that, do it better the next time if it doesn't work the first time. So I think that as long as we're continuing to try, then people will gain the experience, insight, the network, the collection of people who want to do the same thing, that's going to turn it into a larger and larger voice, larger and larger force that will make it happen. And I know that's a simplistic way of thinking about it because there's so much like complicated issues and nuances to the issues that we have out there today. But that's, I think, the general approach is that unless you actually act on what you're wanting to change, it's never going to happen.
I like simplistic way. That's my life motto, is to try and keep it simple. If you don't, if you look at the overall massive problem, it's completely overwhelming and you'll never do anything. So you have to try and keep it simplistic. You've got to recognize, I really like what you're saying, that those feelings of frustration and anger. It starts with recognizing that you're feeling it, going, well, I don't like these feelings. But instead of lashing out about it, be curious and go, well, why am I feeling it? What are the root causes? Why have I got these feelings? And then the next step is to say, well, what can I do about it? What's the one little thing that I can do about it right now? Where do we start? Where do we begin? And it's fantastic how you, and it's just showing in your career, trying to do the little things and making big changes. That's awesome. Got to start wrapping up. Let's do the podcast question. Are you a podcast listener, Ken?
Not as much.
Too busy. Too much work.
Maybe so. But I do have a book that I could mention.
Yeah, go.
So
I'm going to have to interrupt you. Have you at least listened to the Vetveld podcast with David Bessler?
I have not.
You're going to have to listen. Well, you might be sick of listening to David speak.
After this, I'm going to go listen to it, because I've listened to other podcast episodes with him from other podcasts, but I will definitely put it on the list.
Okay, then let me know how they compare. All right, sorry, go ahead. No, and that's fishing for compliments. I won't put that pressure anyway.
It was amazing.
Thank you. That was a real authentic endorsement there by Ken Yagi of the Vetveld podcast. Let's go with your book, please, Ken.
So one of the books that I found interesting that I read recently is called High Conflict. And high conflict is a type of specific type of conflict where there's polarized ends, there's two parties, it's us against them, and it just never gets resolved. It's an ongoing process where it just continues to escalate and it doesn't seem to end ever. And within that, I found the concept of this concept of conflict entrepreneurs very interesting, that sort of excel at riling people up and uses that to pit them against each other, and that somehow leads to their own advancement. And so there are people like that out there that don't want the conflict to end. And so then they do things to escalate the conflict.
So they've got a direct interest in the conflict carrying on, yeah?
Yeah, definitely so. But it might be, so in the book now they talked about, it was something like, it was a dictator regime versus the resistance kind of thing. And so it's a very real situation, very horrible situation that definitely there are people who benefit directly from the conflict ensuing. But if you take it, dial it down to maybe things like social media and how people present messages and things like that, it's somewhat applicable as well. Just as an example, there was an opinion piece posted just yesterday by the Press Herald titled, "Our View, Animal Clinic Didn't Deserve Online Anger." So I don't know if you heard or saw the article about this Maine veterinary facility that has been a target of anger and threats directed at them.
I'm aware of it. I haven't looked into the story, but I felt the ripples all the way across the oceans.
Yeah. And so, like, you know, people who know this, you know, I think they can see that there is actually two sides to this, that there's the pet owner that's very much hurting because that person had to make the excruciating decision of having to surrender their pet. And there's the veterinary team that's hurting from it because of all the bullying that resulted from it and the threats and things like that they're experiencing because of the story going out there and becoming viral. In all this, there's all these angry people who are angry at the veterinary team. How could they take the animal away from the pet owner? And there's all these people angry at the pet owner. Like, how can this person misrepresent the story and, you know, create a situation where the veterinary team is being targeted? And that's how, like, things like suicide in the veterinary field is high and, you know, those kind of things. And so there's all sorts of anger surrounding this. And the question that, like, you know, that we can ask in this is, who's actually gaining from this? Like it feels like every side is losing. But there is a winner in this, that it's the people who incite the anger that gains from it. And so how can we prevent that kind of stuff from happening and affecting us? How can we find common ground and focus our energy that is directed towards anger to solving some of these issues? Why is it that, you know, veterinary healthcare is so hard to afford? And when it comes to these kinds of emergencies, what are ways to prevent the situation where the person is faced with surrendering or euthanizing? What is the way to get the pet owner public to understand how veterinary medicine works? You know, those are the solutions that we need to be thinking about, rather than being angry at each other and escalating the process. What is the true solution here? What's the core issue? And how do we hit that is where we want to be.
It's a big issue, isn't it? It's a, especially in an emergency. I'm sure it's something that you guys, well, in your whole career, you're used to that. You're very much used to that scenario of the dichotomy of, I want to do something, but I can't because of the money. Have you guys, I don't know, it could be a whole, you're allowed to say no, time's up. But have you guys got thoughts about situations like that? How does Veg handle a situation like that?
You know, Veg definitely has thoughts surrounding this. One of the things when I saw the story was that I was so grateful that Veg has something called Veg Cares, that we have a nonprofit that's associated with Veg that the funds are being donated to. So for these situations, we might be able to help the pet owner be able to pay for the care. That's one thing, because somehow there has to be a way to pay for the pet care. But Veg also has a philosophy where we can give stuff away for free. Stuff isn't the word that's used in our philosophy. It's actually the other S word.
you're much more polite than David. David just said it.
So that's a philosophy where it matters, because we can't give away services all the time, but where it matters, where it makes a difference, what are the ways in which we can help and give that service away? This situation where the surrendering being offered to the pet owner, that is stressful to everyone. It's not just the pet owner that is stressful to, it's stressful for our team as well. And so putting our teams in that situation where they have to say, you either have to surrender the animal or euthanize or go somewhere else, we try to alleviate that kind of situation as much as possible. There's a philosophy that we have built into the culture of Veg that solves not just this, but a lot of the different kinds of issues that we've seen in veterinary medicine that seemingly has become the norm. But if we were to fix the issue and really take a look at what's actually broken and the actual solution to that, that's built into our culture.
Still baffles me because I love it. I really like it. And that's, I think every clinic would want to do that. I still struggle with how do you make it work business-wise, financially, and how much shit can you give away for free before it becomes a crippling problem?
That's like, yeah, and this is a hard conversation to navigate with the teams for sure. And so we definitely take a look at that and say, that's why we say, do it when it matters. It's not just because you can't have that tough conversation with the client. It's not to avoid, you know, difficult situations or uncomfortable situations. It's really when you think it's worth it to do so.
Magic. All right, Ken, our last question that we wrap up with, and I'm going to make you do this for vets. I was thinking, should I do it for, we've already asked you the vet tech question, but you're at one of your conferences, the whole room is filled with all of the veterinary new grads for the year, and you've got a few minutes to give them just one little bit of advice. What's your advice?
So what I would like to say to that room full of new grads would be that veterinary medicine has changed over the course of time quite a bit, and where people would just go to the vets to have their pets seen is probably long gone, in that when they say the vets, we're talking about, it's actually the veterinarian, the nurses, the assistants, the receptionist, and there's an entire team surrounding it. So don't forget that, you know, we all have our own respective expertise and specialty area that we bring to the table. And it's how efficiently we work together, how well we communicate, and how well we have that team dynamic set up that's going to help us take care of more pets and their people over the course of time. And so obviously I'm very biased towards the veterinary nurses, that when we think about veterinary medicine, it's traditionally been a very veterinarian-centric thought process and culture. That needs to change in order for it to be sustainable, not just for us, but for you as well. And so thinking about how each of us can help in that regards, whether it's more in the organized medicine side or just in your practice and advocating for your nursing care team. Because if one of the biggest reasons why people are leaving the nursing field is because they don't feel like they have a voice, they don't feel recognized, it's up to everyone on the team, including yourselves, to provide that so that everyone's doing that for each other and it becomes a sustainable career for everyone.
That's a paradigm shift, isn't it? I literally listening to you, it's like something's just clicking in my head there, because it is so, it's always traditionally been so vet-centric. I think I'm the same sort of vintage as you, but so 20 years in the profession. 20 years ago, it was you find your vets, that's the team, and then you have to fill in the spaces around them with support staff to make sure that they can shine. And that's actually, you're right, it is so outdated. It is equally as, it's more important what happens out of the reception desk or at the, when they walk in the door, even than the clinical stuff. So it is a thoughtfulness about creating that team, not to support the vet, but actually just a flat equal team. They all have to shine. Otherwise, it's because it's all about that experience. Exactly as you say, the client expectation is changing. It's about an experience. It's not just about a dog sick, make it better.
I agree all the way through.
Yeah, magic. Okay, that was so cool to talk to you. Marihana spoke highly of you, and she's right to do so. Thank you so much for all the work you do. And I'm so excited to see what comes out of this. And I'm going to come and visit you in the States. I'm going to have to.
Yeah, and come visit anytime. We'll be open arms over here. And I'll make sure that I listen to the David Bessler episode after this.
Our goal here at The Vet Belt is to have conversations like the one you've just listened to. It will give you inspiration and fresh ideas on how to create a thriving and happy career and life as a vet. You'll know by now that our focus is on the life skills that we need to navigate this challenging and rewarding profession of ours. But there's something that I've realized over the last few years of exploring ways to increase enjoyment of the job. That is that the vets who are confident in their skills and knowledge are, as a whole, more satisfied with their careers. Which makes sense. When you feel rusty or uncertain in your knowledge, it's very easy for those imposter feelings to sneak in. I don't know enough. Am I good enough? Conversely, we know that feelings of growth and mastery are some of the greatest predictors of a happy career, which is why we created the VetVelt Clinical Podcast. 3 highly practical episodes every week. Conversations, not lectures, with world-class specialists. Tips, updates, real insights, not textbook theory. Short enough to listen to on your drive to work, but with enough content to ensure that you'll be a little bit better at your job than you were before you listened. Join us on our journey to better by trying out our free 2-week trial at vvn.supercast.tech.